This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Here's where we are today. We've got the changing fortunes of General Electric in a changing economy. We've got what it takes to be in the cattle business. And we've got our series, I've Always Wondered. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday is where we are. It's the 7th of December. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. General Electric is perhaps the original American corporate conglomerate. It started with a light bulb 100-some-odd years ago, worked its way up to appliances and jet engines, even structured finance products. There was nary a slice of the American economy GE didn't have its fingers in. A number of years ago, though, GE changed its mind, decided to slim down, started selling off parts of itself as the economy it was so intertwined with changed. That all changed today. In the face of government antitrust concerns, GE has called off a deal to sell its 100-year-old appliance business to the Swedish company Electrolux for $3.3 billion. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
Americans did their first load of laundry in GE washing machines in 1910, and GE wants so very much for Americans to do their last load of laundry in GE machines in 2000 as soon as possible.
It doesn't want to be selling washers and dryers.
Eric Gordon is professor at University of Michigan's Ross School of Business.
GE wants to become a global leader in just a few sort of heavy industrial businesses.
Like aviation, transportation, power generation, water treatment. In its 123 years, GE has had its fingers in a lot of different pies, and appliances are just not a very lucrative pie anymore. Brian Langenberg runs Langenberg & Company.
When you have a business that used to have double-digit margins and earn pretty good returns, and then the Chinese figure out how to put together sheet metal motors and stuff, and all of a sudden your margins are, you know, more like single digits, it's just not a very attractive business.
As part of its grand strategy to reinvent itself, GE sold off a finance division worth $20-plus billion. It bought this year a French power giant for $10 billion, and it just won a contract to build 1,000 locomotives in India. All of this puts into perspective the failed $3 billion deal to get rid of appliances.
Just because we have a roadblock today and the abandoned deal doesn't necessarily mean that one won't get done, you know, in the near future.
Barbara Novarini is with Morningstar.
There should still be, you know, plenty of buyers out there who'd be interested.
Probably, she says, in Asia. With everything else GE has cooking, getting stuck with an appliance business for a few more years, they'll deal. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Privacy and technology types have been doing a lot of parsing of President Obama's Oval Office address last night. One part in particular, the bit about how he's going to, and this is a quote, urge high-tech and law enforcement leaders to basically stop terrorists from using the latest technology to do what it is that they do. Marketplace's Annie Baxter looks at what that might mean for technology companies in actual practice.
When you talk or text using technology from companies like Apple or WhatsApp, that information gets encrypted or scrambled to prevent hacking, including hacking by governments that might want to listen in. At a briefing today, White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest said President Obama doesn't want to violate people's civil liberties when they use encrypted communications.
At the same time, the people who have designed these communications tools certainly didn't design them to aid and abet a terrorist.
Nima Singh Gulyani is a legislative counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union. She's concerned the president could push tech companies to give the government its own window onto encrypted communications. She says tech companies are hesitant to do that because it would weaken protections for all consumers.
It's sort of like having a window in your house. Everybody can look in that window. Everybody can potentially break that window. There's no way to build a private window that only one or two people would have access to.
Others are concerned the government might get more involved in policing social media accounts. J.M. Berger co-wrote ISIS, The State of Terror, and has studied the terrorist group's use of social media. He says that letting governments decide when to take down social media sites is a slippery slope. He says that's been the case with Turkey and Russia.
And their definition of who's a terrorist and whose speech should be allowed can be very different from what we would think.
Still, Berger thinks there are big data tools that can assess real terrorists' activity, and he thinks social media companies might be better at that kind of thing than the government. So he says getting the president to meet with tech companies could be useful, but it wouldn't hurt to have civil liberties groups there. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, not so good. Could have been worse, but not so good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We are, as of today, into the second week of the UN's climate conference in Paris. If, and it's not a small if here, but if we have a deal on this thing by Friday, countries will, in no particular order, formalize their individual pledges to cut greenhouse gas emissions. They will promise to be transparent in doing so along the way. They will agree to pay for poor countries to be able to afford new sources of energy, and they will lock in future meetings on this to keep themselves honest. It is, however, one thing to promise to overhaul the world's energy economy. It is, in reality, quite another. Scott Tong of our sustainability desk is on the line to discuss. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Kai.
Let me start with a what if, all right? Mm. Let's say, come the end of this week, they wrap things up in a neat little bow and they say, ready, switch from fossil fuels. How long is that going to take?
And these things always go perfectly,
yes,
as you know. Well, right now, we live in a world where 80% of the energy the world gets comes from coal or oil or gas. That's according to the International Energy Agency. So how quickly could we turn all that over? On a super-duper optimistic end, we could do it in 30 years.
Ooh,
there's a study out there that says, okay, if you took every piece of the energy infrastructure, power plant lasts 30, 40, 50 years, car lasts 15 or 20 years, let it live its natural life, die a natural death, and replace it with a carbon-free energy source, perhaps in 3 or 4 decades, you could do that, intellectually.
Okay, what about realistically then? I mean, give me the flip side of the coin.
Let's look at a little history and what that's taught us. Let's talk about coal for a second. It first came on the scene as a replacement for wood made fire at the start of the 18th century.
Okay.
It took about 5 decades for it to go mainstream, and 200 years later today,
wow,
it might be peaking,
wow,
right? So we're 2 centuries into the coal age. Oil is the relative newbie, only a century, century and a half of oil. Today's wind and solar technologies came from ideas that were proven in the 40s and 50s. So orders of magnitude, we're talking about decades, centuries.
Wow.
I spoke this morning with energy historian Christopher Jones at Arizona State University, and he says it's not just energy eras are long. Every new energy we've seen so far has been layered one on top of the old one. He calls it additive.
And so one of our central challenges right now is to pioneer a different type of energy transition, one that's not simply focused on increasing the role of renewables, but one that actually thinks about how to wean off of coal and oil and natural gas.
Well, how does that weaning happen, though, right? Because that is, no matter what the circumstance, it's never an easy process.
And I don't know if we've ever done it before, to wean off of an energy source. Now, Jones and other historians say the key is policy. Much of the inertia for today's energy system is hardware and laws and subsidies making the incumbent fossil fuels a good money-making investment. So now today we have proven affordable solar energy, wind energy, but Jones says technology does not equal destiny. So to push them into the market, you'd need new policies and rules to steer to the outcomes you want. You know, for instance, subsidizing new energy production, renewables, putting a price on carbon emissions. So, you know, right now we all dump our CO2 trash in the atmosphere for free. We should start to pay for it. That's the idea.
One last thing, Scott, and then I'm going to let you go. The economy today moves a bajillion miles an hour, as we talk about all the time. It seems like what you're telling me is that the energy economy, it just can't keep up. It's not moving fast enough.
When we talk about the economy, right, we talk about the business cycle. It's years, maybe it's a decade long, right? That's what a business cycle is. With energy, there's all this inertia in the system keeping stuff out there for a long time, right? My car's on its 17th year. Cars are going to be on the road for 20 years. Power plants are sitting there for 40, 50 years. There are a billion cars in the world that have to turn over. That's the kind of inertia that's in the system now, which is why turning it over is going to take that much time.
Scott Tong,
at the Sustainability Desk in Washington. Thank you, Scott.
Okay, you're welcome.
There are few things more typically American in the imagination than cattle and cowboys. There's romance involved and a sense of history, money to be made as well. Cattle ranching is actually a going concern in the western part of this country, but it looks a whole lot different than it did even 20 or 30 years ago. The demands of a successful cattle business have changed educationally and generationally. Marketplace's Andy Euler went down to Texas to get the story for us.
When you walk into the Hills Prairie Livestock Auction in Bastrop, Texas, you see a lot of young cattle getting ready for the feedlot. The auction is held every Wednesday at noon adjacent to the cattle pens. It feels a little bit like a miniature rodeo. Cattlemen sit in the balcony and watch the steers waltz back and forth on the stage. When Clint McDonald isn't auctioning off the cattle, he's out in the hall checking the futures market.
This is the board, the cattle futures board, and that's what everybody's looking at. And when the board goes down, the cattle go down.
It's easy to forget that for all the belt buckles, boots, and cowboy hats, these men and women are commodities traders. Jared Milton's family has owned about 800 acres in Bastrop County since the First World War. He's been working cattle on the land for more than 40 years and says some of the time it feels like you're in Las Vegas.
You can take a $20,000 risk and turn it to a $2,000 risk. You know, you can afford to play the game a little bit. I caught several of the market turns and you know, made some money every now and paid for the truck and that sort of thing. It was a lot of fun. But it's not something that works all the time. You know, you've really got to be a student of the market.
A student of the market and a student of many other things. At least that's what Jeff Guider would argue. Guider is director of the Institute of Ranch Management at Texas Christian University. His students study soil and water conservation, ranch finance. There's even a class on marketing livestock and meat.
It's how to blend the economical and ecological aspects of land stewardship, not just in ranching but farming, but in managing all natural resources.
Guider says a lot of his students come from farm and ranching families, but more and more are new to the industry. They're treating it like business school. He thinks that's a good thing, because again, at the Hills Prairie Auction, you're going to see a lot of young cattle and a lot of old men.
Most of the people on these farms and ranches are, you know, in their 50s, 60s, 70s. There's a huge void of people that are going to come in and operate and take over those businesses. It's an absolute statement to the industry of where we are today. There's very little middle ground, if you will. There's young people and there's old people.
The auction's got at least one example of age disparity in the form of Shelley Crenshaw and her young granddaughter.
Pretty much every Wednesday we come and hang out, eat lunch, and watch the cows go through. And my granddaughter loves to come.
Crenshaw's not in the cattle business. She's got what she calls a one-cow operation. She found a calf on her 5 acres in Bastrop that had lost its mother. And she decided to take care of it.
If you would have asked me 10 years ago, a city girl like me, bottle feeding baby calves, I would have told you were crazy.
Will Crenshaw's granddaughter catch the bug and want to get into the cattle business? There's no telling. Jared Milton doesn't have grandkids to leave his ranch to. He never got married. He's 65, but says he's not ready to sell off the land just yet.
You know, why would I go and try to make more money and give this up when all I have to do is stay here and work it, and I have this, and why would I work except to come back out here? You know, in a way, that's what makes America work, is the chance that every now and then you can really make some money if you're doing something.
Nowadays in the cattle business, doing something still means getting out there to dig post holes and mend fences. But it also means pulling out your phone to check the latest cattle futures and beef prices. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
No one president can act and do that all by himself, but it's politically the correct thing to do. You try to get the voters' attention.
The tax man cometh to our segment I've always wondered, but first, let's do the numbers. Now, what are they, mandolins? Is that where we are now with this? I don't even know. The Dow Industrial's off 117 points today, 2/3%, closed at 17,730. The NASDAQ off 40 points, 8/10%, 5101. The S&P 500 down 14 points, 7/10%, 2077. Crude oil closed down 5.6% today, $37.73 a barrel. and thus energy companies took a hit. ExxonMobil down 2.6%. Chevron shed 2.7%. Other stocks, however, since this is capitalism, got a boost from low oil prices. Airlines, for instance, Delta up 4%. American Airlines 1.8% higher today. Bond prices rose as well. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.23%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Venezuelans woke up this morning to a revolution of sorts, or maybe a counter-revolution, to be completely accurate about it. In elections yesterday, the main opposition party won most of the seats in the National Assembly. Socialist President Nicolas Maduro, handpicked for the job, remembered by President Hugo Chavez before he died, has said he has accepted the results, but he is not happy about it at all. The BBC's Daniel Pardo is in the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. Daniel, good to speak with you.
Thanks for having me.
President Maduro said today that he would accept the results of this election, but he did blame something he called the economic war against him. That's a quote from him. What do you suppose he meant by that?
Well, he's repeating the argument that he's been saying along the years to justify the economic crisis that Venezuelans are living. He says that there's a conspiracy between the United States, the far right in this country, but also in Colombia and other countries that want to topple Maduro and topple the revolution in order to get the oil that this country has in their hands. So he's just repeating an argument that we know that most Venezuelans show that they don't believe.
All right, so compare and contrast that with the reality of falling oil prices, which is a lot of what has happened to the Venezuelan economy, right?
Well, it is a lot, but it's not the main thing. Most economists here in Venezuela, what they say is that the reason for this crisis has to do with the model, the socialist model that this government has put in place in the economy. Today, Venezuelans are living with a critical situation in which they lose most of their money every day in a high inflation world that is crazy and it's full of distortions.
All the subsidies then that the Chavez and Maduro governments gave on virtually everything. I mean, gas, I've read at the pump, costs a penny or less a gallon. All of that didn't sway the population.
Most people in Venezuela do want that model to stay. Venezuelans are very used to subsidies. Many people were saying yesterday that se acabó la regaladera, meaning the giving away from the government has ended. But I don't think that's going to end. It's a population that it's used to subsidies. It's a population that like to have TVs for free, which is the main reason why Chavez was so popular and was able to reelect himself indefinitely and has been popular in the last 17 years. Even the opposition is saying that they actually have to just rethink the way that the Venezuelan people live from the government. But it's very unlikely that that's going to change.
So when you go out and you go to a supermarket, or if you go to, I don't know, a cafe or a restaurant, what will the conversation be tomorrow morning?
Venezuela is a very politicized country. It's been always about politics since I got here 2 years ago. They talk about politics all the day. And when they start a conversation about, I don't know, baseball or health, it ends up in politics. So this time, tomorrow morning, we'll have a conversation that is filled with hope of change. But it's something that they've been talking about for ages. And it doesn't seem that it's going to end. Like, I feel that Venezuelans are addicted to politics, and I don't think that's going to change in the meantime because the opposition is always responding as well to that scenario, to that way of seeing life.
Daniel Pardo, the BBC's correspondent in Caracas. Daniel, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, guys.
Fall 2015 is turning out to be pretty good for the American labor market. Thank you very much. There was the November jobs report that we got on Friday. That put us right about at 220,000 new jobs every single month on average since the summertime. The unemployment rate, as you know, sits at about 5% even, actually exactly 5% even. But there is an exception here you need to know about, and it's one that worries economists a little bit. What are called prime age workers, people between 25 and 54 in the prime of their working and earning years, haven't really come back into the labor force since the recession. Marketplace's Mitchell Harbin explains why that matters.
The unemployment rate's down to where it was when the recession started, but that's partly because so many former workers aren't even looking anymore. Elise Gould at the Liberal Economic Policy Institute focuses most on prime-age workers.
25 to 54 years old, and you get rid of any sort of demographic shifts that are happening with baby boomer retiring or whether or not young people may be sheltering in school. There are still over a million missing workers that have left the labor force, have stopped actively looking, or haven't started actively looking.
But why? There are more job openings now. Employers are upping pay, especially for entry-level jobs in retail and fast food. Michael Strain at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute says many workers dropped out of semi-skilled occupations like construction and manufacturing. They're used to making decent wages, and what's on offer now may not be worth it.
For those workers, wages have actually fallen, and that in and of itself is a compelling reason for those workers not to enter the workforce.
Strain thinks government safety net programs like disability might be helping some people make ends meet without punching in for a paycheck. And there may be societal changes at work, too.
You know, whether it's becoming, in some sense, culturally less difficult to go for long periods of time without having a job.
For instance, it may be more common now for people to live at home until their early 30s, or for families to live on a single income so one parent can provide childcare full time. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Once a month on this program, we do a segment that is all about you. Your questions, to be just a tad more precise, about business and the economy and what you might be curious about. It's a segment that we call I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
Today, a topic that seems to be every presidential candidate's favorite punching bag.
We need to actually reform the tax code. Go to a 3-page tax code.
Make the tax code fairer, flatter, and simpler.
We have to drive a stake through the heart of the IRS and our terrible tax code.
I will rewrite the tax code so it rewards hard work and investments here at home, not quick trades or stashing profits overseas.
We had Marketplace's Kimberly Adams tackle this question from listener Rick Stone of Papillion, Nebraska.
Why does it appear like no politician knows how the tax code is generated?
Something about the way the presidential candidates talk about the tax code seems a little off to Rick.
As I thought I understood it from civics class, the tax code was created every time somebody created a law that gave somebody a tax break.
That somebody creating laws being Congress.
The IRS's job was just to compile that into a single document so that everybody could find it.
You seem pretty knowledgeable about the tax code. Have you taken any classes, or are you just remembering what you learned in civics?
That's exactly it. Just what I remember from high school civics.
I thought his teacher would be so proud, so I tracked her down.
My full name is Sandra K. Dashley, and I was a teacher at Linda McKinley High School. I taught social studies, government history.
For 33 years in Columbus, Ohio, Ms. Deichley is now in her 70s and still lives in Columbus. Over the years, she figures she taught about 1,500 students, stuff like tax basics and how to file their returns.
I would explain the tax rate, how it worked, and then when we talked about taxes, we would talk about whether taxes were fair for everyone.
So I asked her Rick's question about the tax code and whether presidents have the power to change it.
Of course not. No one president can act and do that all by himself, but it's politically the correct thing to do. You try to get the voters' attention.
Rick remembered his lessons well, but there's something else. Making the tax code simpler could actually create more work for the IRS. That's according to Eugene Sturley, a tax policy expert at the Urban Institute.
This 611 is the broader allowance of deduction for depletion.
He showed me a copy of the tax code.
Most of the words that are written down are written by IRS and Treasury in interpreting the law. The law itself is small compared to these regulations and rulings.
The tax code is the law, written and passed by Congress. But there are tens of thousands of pages of explanations, regulations, and legal decisions that go with it.
Sometimes the law is a very simple statement. It might be two sentences defining some very complex area of the law. So in that case, you're going to have a huge number of words trying to define exactly what that means.
Sounds complicated, and that's why I didn't explain it that way.
Sandra Deitchley says the high schoolers she taught in the 70s just wanted to know how to get their refunds.
Occasionally, I still, when I was teaching, would have a student come back and say, will you check my taxes for me? So after school, I would look over their tax forms.
Others, like Rick Stone, held on to what they learned for decades. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Like I said at the beginning, we need you to make this segment work. So please send us your questions, whatever you might have been wondering about. There's a link where you can do that on our website. It's marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, which involves LeBron James, the American stock market, Nike, and buckets full of cold hard cash. The company announced this afternoon it has signed James to a lifetime endorsement deal, its first lifetime contract with an athlete ever. Exact size of the buckets of cash was not disclosed. ESPN reports that it's the biggest single athlete contract Nike has ever done. And remember, that includes Tiger Woods and Michael Jordan. Nike shares, by the way, popped 1% after hours on that news. Alrighty, we got to go. A little bit squeezed for time here. The Dow off 117 points, 2/3%. The NASDAQ down 40 points, 8/10%. The S&P 500 off 14.7%. There. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.